Hello and welcome to the Baby Giants Investing Podcast. Join us as we chat about the weird and wild world of small cap investing, all while searching for the precious few fast-growing businesses that have a shot at becoming industry giants.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be relied upon as the basis for investment decisions. Podcast guests and their clients may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
All right, we're live. Thanks very much for joining me, gents. We're in the midst of quarterly season, or I guess it's just finished as we're doing this. What should we chat about today? I assume you guys want to chat about some quarterlies.
Yeah, I think we have to. There's a bit of a mixed bag as always. So, yeah, keen to go through some numbers.
They're the babies. The babies are the ones that have to report quarterlies, right? Because it's companies that aren't, you know, yet cash flow positive or haven't proven that they are through a year or something like that.
That's right. That's the rule. I can't remember the exact specifics, but as companies get bigger, they tend to graduate away from having to report quarterlies. Which is always a nice moment as an investor. Kind of a mixed one, actually, because you get fewer updates.
Yeah.
But it's like a teen moving out of the house or something. It's like,
what are you up to?
You get much fewer updates with a teen.
You're definitely going to be concerned if they come back too soon, put it that way.
That's true. Yeah, cool. All right. Well, who wants to kick off? Any what caught your guys' eye?
Have we got no good news this week?
That's true. We've got actually quite a bit of good news. Like, I forgot that a couple of weeks ago as well. Let me find it. So do you guys have any good news while I find some of the other stuff?
I don't actually. I was waiting for you to come back with something, but I'm sure there's been some good news somewhere around the world.
The first US small modular nuclear reactor got certified. A promising gene therapy delivers treatment directly to the brain. What else we got? New treatment strategy cuts risk of bowel cancer returning by 28%. And Astroforge, which is an asteroid mining startup, is launching its first space missions this year. Bacteria eating plastic dumped in the sea. I'm actually super bullish on this one long term. I feel like the age of synthetic biology, that we could engineer something to solve a lot of our problems of global warming and plastic pollution and stuff.
As long as we don't suffer the grey goo.
The idea would be you create something which just expands, like you create something that just eats all the plastic, which this is what this is doing. But the problem would be if it kept expanding and ate like all the plastic in the world, and we're like throwing back to the stone.
I know I'm not the best at good news, but I do have one.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I know I always manage to make it somehow negative, but still, the good news is Germany and US giving tanks to Ukraine.
I mean, that can definitely be somehow negative.
You can read that a couple of ways.
That was a big moment for Ukraine.
I struggle with good news, but there we go. That's my good news. I'm doing my best, guys.
That's a very big move. One other one was that anti-aging gene injections could rewind your heart age by 10 years. And some other knife that apparently can smell tumors can detect a cancer within seconds. All right. Very cool.
A knife? Did you say?
Yeah, it's for surgeries, I think.
A smelling knife. There you go.
Actually, given that we're,
I didn't have that on my 2023 bingo card. That's for sure.
Given that we cover the arts at A Rich Life, I definitely actually have to give a shout out for some improved arts funding, which is supposedly in the pipeline now. So actually that is some good news on the local front for, the arts and culture industry. And it's been a tough few years for that space.
Very cool. All right, let's get into, I guess we've got hopefully some more good news if we're talking about some positive companies. Maybe they won't all be good news if they're in 4C season. What caught your guys' eye?
I'll kick off for one first and we'll just tag team it, I suppose. Ava Risk Group caught my attention. The code is AVA. We've touched on it before.
First episodes, I think we chatted about that.
Well, yeah, it was way back in the early days. So they do perimeter detection, essentially. They've got a bit of cool tech that sort of uses fiber optics as a sensing solution. They also do smart locks for high value sites. They do cameras, illumination, all kinds of things. And it's been a bit of a tricky business to analyze because they, as we said at the time, they divested themselves of this very big and very profitable and very successful services division to focus on what they felt were bigger growth opportunities, better margin opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. So it sort of makes comparisons a little bit hard. And then you've also got this new acquisition with GJD. I struggle to say that every time. But overall, they had revenue from continuing operations expected to be up about 50% for the half. That's 13.6 million. So the previous guidance was 13 to 15. So a little bit below the halfway mark, but still very strong growth. And just for context, last year continuing operations was 19 million or so. So it's a pretty strong number. We've spoken to the outgoing CEO previously. It was pretty high conviction on the fact that their cost base was able to see much greater scales than the rest of it. So we should see a bit of profit come through to the bottom line for all of this kind of stuff, which is nice. Also encouraging, they received a bunch of strategically important orders for Aura IQ. This is a new sort of use case for their tech that they use on conveyor belts in mines and ports, etc. It sort of took a lot longer to sort of come to fruition than I think a lot of shareholders were expecting, but it'll be good to see some of those orders sort of come through and start to being delivered on. But yeah, overall, thesis on track for me, growth continuing, balance sheet very strong, cash flow positive, and valuation.
Do you own shit? Do you own shares, mate?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, sorry, I should disclose. Yeah, absolutely, I do. 15 million in cash, no debt, and I think probably...
I thought you were going to say you had 15 million in shares for a second there.
No, I'm not. I don't muck around with less than 20 million positions, my friend. Yeah, so I reckon it's probably on about 10 times EBITDA, very, very rough thumb suck based on what the full year should bring. So, yeah, that's the first one I'm bringing to bear. Ava.
Yeah, sweet. Thanks, mate. And just for anyone listening who's not familiar with the story, you might look at Ava Group and see, oh, the share price is down massively, but actually there was a huge capital return. So I think that explains at least one of the drops that there anyway, I think.
Yeah, 16 cents or thereabouts in total with like partly in dividend, partly
yeah,
in terms so of maybe capital return. So yeah, it's stubbornly, I don't know, I'm biased, but it feels to me it's remained stubbornly cheap. The market really didn't get excited by these results. But I don't know. It seems like everything's on track. So, and it also seems to me as one that's pretty resilient in terms of the industries it serves and what it does, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of things you think the market would be more focused on these days, i.e. decent balance sheet, good cash flows, continuing top line growth, ability to scale, et cetera, et cetera. But there it is. There it is. I've talked about it again, so you'll probably get a chance to buy it at 15 cents.
Right. I'll talk about one that I don't own because I didn't really monitor it closely enough, which is a failure on my part. So apologies to my readers there. Doug, D-U-G. So a few years ago, this listed and didn't perform particularly well, so it kind of fell off my watch list. Back in December last year, they put out a trading update that operational update that disclosed that they had secured a ton of new services projects, which is not a really... Well, the real question is how recurring are these services? So we can discuss that in a second. I don't know the answer, but these can obviously be up and down. This was a 380% increase. That was in December. That was pretty much the bottom for the stock. That was the time when I think it jumped up from about 45 to 50 cents. Pretty wild, really. That's a 10% jump. If I'd been paying attention, covered that, would have been great because the share price has absolutely moved up to 80 cents in recent times. And this quarterly report that they just put out, you know, showed a very strong increase in cash flow. And I'm talking about operating cash flow now. So to operating cash flow positive, they said they were profitable for the quarter. So huge inflection point, which was sort of forecast in that December announcement, which is why I'm kicking myself that I didn't write about that and pick that up.
Should we just take a step back, Claude, with what they do? Because I don't think we chatted about them before. This is a high-performance computing data center, right? So it's out in Perth. And, I think their technology, I remember that was unique about it, well, somewhat unique, was that the server racks were in a liquid, basically. They were, like, cooled in a different way, which is some of their unique technologies, like in an oil. Basically submerged so that the heat is like dissipated. Heat is a big problem in servers. It started out of his garage or shed and has just expanded from there. And a lot of high performance compute, which would be for instance, like a big miner might use it to do some really intense data analysis or something else, something predictive or just intense modeling where you need something bigger and better than, you know, what you can get elsewhere. And Google has high performance compute, Amazon has high performance compute. So maybe one scary thing is that you're competing with those guys. But yeah, that's kind of the realm of competitors. It's not your day-to-day cloud stuff. It's some very specialized stuff.
When you said mining, my mind went somewhere else for a second. Like, oh, really? Oh, I got a bit excited for a second there. Anyway, continue, please.
I don't think they have any crypto exposure. I don't. That's a.
No. Sorry, oh my God! How did we get on the crypto?
I did it. I found a way. Please continue.
Yeah, that was all for just to explain what they do. But yeah.
Thank you, Matt. That was much called for, and appreciate that. So, just diving in on that theme, some of the services that they do: seismic processing, Doug D-Blend, realize the full potential of some data. Anyway, I actually don't understand it. I can read you the words. Realize the full potential of blended acquisition without compromising data quality or amplitude fidelity with our inversion-based deep blending algorithm. So as you can probably tell, I'm coming fairly new to this story after you know, realizing that there's been this sort of inflection point in their revenues for these services. Now, they're actually a few different services, so don't anchor to the one that I randomly read out. Petrophysics is part of it as well. You know, it'd be interesting to know what's driving the huge uptick and how sustainable it is, because it has driven an inflection point in the finances. And of course, as is the case with small cap investing, sometimes the early bird getting the worm, where you benefit is if you're just always following a company. If someone was always following Doug, they saw the announcement in December last year, you know, then they would understand its significance. That's when those people got to buy before that information filtered through to the quarterly and all of that sort of situation, which is where we're talking about it now. So, you know, for that reason, I think it does still have to be on the wait list, on the watch list rather, because if this is a step change in, you know, their product market fit, or even if it's a cyclical impact that's going to last for a couple of years or something, then, you know, their results could dramatically improve, and that's why I'm basically saying this was a newsworthy quarterly. Although I don't own shares myself, it put the stock on my watch list for that reason. Any comments on that before we move on?
No, I think that's fair. I think it has been a bit lumpy sometimes in the past. Even in that update, you can kind of see in like January 2022 there was a big spike and then it declined, and that's part of why I think the shares hadn't done well. So yeah, that would be the, I think you've nailed the question you need to answer. Is this an inflection point for a big sea change, or is this something a bit more temporary? And yeah, if anyone has any thoughts, you can always hit us up on.
Yeah, that's a research task. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just can't get the edge, and perhaps the little inflection point on the big sales lumpiness, you know, that might be over, or it could be secular, but one to watch now. Anyway, moving on, because we had a whole bunch of quarterlies and we weren't even able to cover a small fraction of them all, I thought I would chuck in Camplify, not a stock I own at the moment, one I've bought and sold previously, but obviously I think we have talked about it, can't remember, but for those not aware, there's a website, you can go and check it out, Camplify. You could either rent out your camper van to somebody else, or you know, you could go there to hire a camper van in order to do a you know, holiday over January.
I've used them before. It was, yeah.
Oh yeah, tell us about your experience.
Yeah, it was great. Connected with a guy not too many suburbs across. Had a great little van for a trip up to the Dubbo Zoo and back for a few nights. It was really easy, really straightforward. So yeah, it's one single data point, but it was a good one.
Yeah, nice.
Having said that, anyway, though, like, he was such a nice guy. Like, I think if we were to do it again, I'd just like contact him directly. I guess that's a risk for repeat business. Yeah. But
sure. Although he may prefer it through Camplify if stuff like their insurance, etc.,
that's very
is
true. Yes.
Meaningful for him.
Very true.
Which it probably is, because it's kind of a big asset, right? So
yeah. Depending on how much they trust you and you get along, but yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, Airbnb stuff tends to stay on there. But of course, differences with Camplify versus Airbnb is, you know, generally the economics are different because generally property, not always, but generally property that you can live in, residential property, tends to be value, an asset that increases in value. So somebody could, you know, own a house, monetize it through Airbnb, plus they over the long term probably have an asset that goes up in value. Whereas camper vans are the opposite in the sense that over time as they get older, they're an asset that drops in value. So I think that makes the economics, you know, the Airbnb of camper vans, it's not really quite the right metaphor for that reason. So that's something to keep in mind with Campify. Having said all of that, as you would expect, we saw a really strong quarter this quarter with 32.5 million receipts from customers, operating cash flow positive. Nice to see. However, just a big reminder to everyone about the cyclicality of this business due to the fact that somebody will book a holiday in the December quarter but not take that holiday in until the January month, because in Australia, for example, and I think it's the same in New Zealand, you know, school holidays break up second half of December, then you have all of January for holidays. So you're obviously going to, a lot of people will book a January holiday by the time that December comes around. So just keep an eye out for that. Don't get too excited by annualizing one quarter of this, obviously. So having said all that, it's another one I continue to watch. And, you know, their revenue was up. They have also grown through acquisitions as well. So again, it's a little bit hard to parse out exactly, you know, a smooth trajectory based on even, especially just talking about one quarter, especially when it's got 1 month of the Paul Camper business in it. And also, you know, they did a New Zealand acquisition not long ago. So the prior corresponding period aren't necessarily the best. And with lockdowns and everything, yeah, just very hard to get a clean read on where these guys are. But what we can say is, you know, increasing number of transactions is going on the platform, more camper vans on there. I would hope more people using it to book. And, you know, it says once they've included the pool camper feet, it's 24.5K, which I think was up a little bit on what they said when they did the acquisition. I actually have to check that. Either way, point is, zoom out. What we really care about is how strong is this the network of people that are wanting to rent camper vans plus then people wanting to go and buy them. In my view, it's more of the information in the half yearly and the yearly that helps us with that. They have a number of different revenue streams and revenue accounting. You got insurance, you got camper van sales. I got this and the other. It's really hard to get, for me, meaningful information from a quarter. Nonetheless, still, I thought the share price went up on it, so the market liked it. So metrics moving in the right direction, generally a decent one there.
Do you guys think that there's a risk that an Airbnb get into that as a segment? Or do they already? I'm not actually sure. Do they offer camper vans and stuff? Or?
No, I don't think they do. And I think that would be a scary risk for Camperfy.
Seems like something that would be reasonably adjacent for them, whether or not they're bothered to. I don't know. Do you have a view, Matt?
I reckon that, you know, basically it's unlikely that Airbnb would necessarily go into that, and that I think the nature, because I hate to say it, but that would be probably making Airbnb's business a little bit worse with the depreciating assets. I'd much prefer Airbnb over Uber, put it that way. Mm-hmm. I guess that's putting a bit sidetracked. Because they're always, you know, I think we used to say with Nearmap, you know, Google Maps is going to take it over in the end. And, you know, that was the fear. That was one of the risks I remember highlighting and writing about that, it, you know, when the stock was at 42 cents and went to $4 and then got taken over at something way less than that. But The point is, yeah, there can be a bigger guy does this kind of risks to these kind of businesses for sure. Mm. But, you know, maybe after mentioning Nearmap, that you want to take it on Pointera, a little company that isn't completely different, Andrew.
So there is a nice segue there. It had let's put it this way: the market reaction was pretty brutal. Shares were down 20, I think, percent at the end of the day. That's a move from 22 cents to 18 cents. Not to try and downplay the significance of the move, but you know, it's not uncommon for these kind of small companies. So So the story here was, you know, some good traction with US utilities, all the excitement and potential in the world sort of still remains there. But the thing that the market was quite disappointed on, there was a drop in cash receipts. There was a drop in free cash flow. Again, another quarter of losses. They're getting pretty thin on the ground in terms of the buffer. It's like, I think, $2.7 million in cash. They burned through close to $1 million this quarter. The company, to be fair, has long made gone to some lengths to sort of point out the lumpiness and the different contracting cycles and all the rest of it, which is fair. But they've also said that, you know, they expect that to smooth out over time, and it's just not showing any signs of that so far. So it's there is, I think, you mentioned it before with this idea of, well, recurring revenue is meant to be recurring. And yeah, okay, there's certain timing factors from one quarter to the next, but it's not really sort of starting to flow through. So I think that's what had the market a bit unnerved.
Was it cash? So do you think it was cash burn or just lumpiness of cash receipts that?
I think it was a question of both, frankly.
Yeah. Okay.
So there is a lot of the tech is really cool. Like, it is legitimate. World leader in this very narrow niche that they do, but one with a very big potential and lots of optionality, definitely getting some really good traction, particularly in the US utility sector. So they've worked hard to get some good reference sites and stuff there. Ian's talked about that repeatedly, even recently when he came and spoke to us, so that's all good. But of course, you know, it's sort of like, well, that's all great, but, you know, we'd like to see the money. And yes, we're sympathetic towards the lumpy nature of it, but it's just that it's not smoothing out, or at least the volatility isn't at least in a favorable direction. And so
It's always been a bit like this. Now, like, I'm pretty sure, you know, we've talked about this before, but I think you bought this years ago, right? I want to say like at 7 or 8 cents, or I have no idea when, but I remember you talking about it to me then. And I'd sort of chickened out of it because I never saw, even at those lower levels, the cash receipts matching up with the annualized contract values. Yeah. And I still think that's the jarring thing about it for me. In October, they say ACV now totals US 20.1 million. Mm. And then, you know, and then the cash receipts come in at 2 million AUD. Mm. You're just like, what?
Yes.
And
it just doesn't gel. It does. I mean, I'm not suggesting for a second there's anything untowards happening. They've got customers who are paying their invoices on an annual, even biannual basis, right? So that's fine. Mm. And they're often in a very, very small base. And some of these are very big enterprise sort of customers. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff mixed in with it. And some are paying quarterly. So, I mean, you do. But, again, this isn't something, oh, it's a bad result, here's our excuse. They have said this every single quarterly result for as long as I can remember. But it's just more the fact that it's kind of like...
Yeah, well, they even put in a chart sort of saying, look, you know, our receipts always lag our ACV massively. But
yeah,
it's still strange, right? They put it up there. I'm referring to the announcement on the 31st of October now, but perhaps I should be looking at the most recent one if the same chart's there. But... it's not there. Anyway, it still doesn't make sense. It's still strange to me to see, you know, at the end of, say, Q4 FY2022, the ACV in US dollars is 18.2 million, mm-hmm. but the cumulative customer receipts for FY2022 was 7.8 million AUD. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, wow, that's such a small fraction. Anyway, interesting.
One of our members, Baker Dozen, actually put up a chart. They always have this sort of chart there, and there's one that was sort of ominously missing there, which sort of looks at that ACV versus accumulated cash receipts.
And can be a bit of an orange flag, right?
As we chat about that. Yeah. Okay, so someone else noticed what I just came across then when I was trying to. We're trying to keep it fresh, so I don't know that we're going to talk about Pointera.
Yeah, totally. So you can understand the market's reaction. Right. So it's sort of, as I said, a plausible explanation. It's just one that's kind of probably wearing a bit thin with investors is my guess. So, and I should disclose I hold shares still.
Do they need to raise again, Andrew? Is that part of the concern? Or
I think so. There was a vague reference in there that the core business continues to be self-funding its organic growth. It's like,
all the rest of it.
So... And they are increasing headcount. I mean, it's a really tiny business. I think there's, I forget the number off the top of my head, but it's like 35 staff, full-time equivalents, you know, over and a big part in Perth. And so it's a tiny company. They're no doubt.
It's a fascinating area. Sorry to cut you off. Like, as we talked about before, I think it portends well to augmented reality and a lot of digital twin stuff. I guess my concern with it might have been whether the, my initial concern was that the staff might be doing more service work. So, like, less you're selling software and more you're selling these smart staff members that you have to do more bespoke stuff. I do think, though, that they clearly do have some leading software. Like, I think if you look into that, it's hard to argue, but again, it's still such a small, nascent industry. Maybe that's part of what's going on. Yeah. Even if you do have software that's relatively significant in the space, it's just still a tiny space as well.
But that's a kind of, I mean, this is, I might be drawing a long bow here, but we all know and love Pro Medicus very well. And that was a story of a structural shift within an industry.
It's a good company to compare to.
It's like, I'm picking a very favorable example here. But
our version of the Amazon thing.
Yeah, I was going to say. Oh, and Amazon,
Disclosure, I own Pro Medicus. Sure. But it is, what am I trying to say here? It is so vastly superior to the existing methodology of capturing, storing, visualizing, overlaying tools with geospatial data. And it has really wide use cases and the rest of it. It's just sort of like it's such a small business. So I imagine that they're facing a lot of these growth challenges, particularly as the world has moved on to a very more conservative stance. So I mean, every time Ian has spoken to us, and he's done it a couple times, he's been very impressive. He's definitely got a salesman characteristic about him, but there's, I don't know, he's always been very well received, and I think the potential and the vision is really exciting. It's just now it's a case of and the overall sort of metrics that they're highlighting definitely trending in the right directions, but it's just a case of can they cross that hurdle of going from a small business to a bigger business while maintaining costs and continuing sales momentum. So we'll see, but it's 20% cheaper now if you're interested.
Nice. Maybe we'll jump around to one that we haven't chatted about, I don't think, before. I've mentioned it probably one other place, I think, that we own it. So I mentioned it here, which is Mader Group. And again, I don't really love talking about companies that I own in the pod, but this is one we've owned and held for a while. So, you know, just clear, as we say in the disclaimer at the start, it's not a recommendation, not investment advice. But yeah, I get maybe an overview of Mader Group, and then they had some quarterly updates out as well. So very different from Pointera. It's a mining services business, which the first thing I hear about that is most mining services businesses are just terrible businesses. What I think, they're terrible because they're cyclical. They tend to be very capital intensive. They go through these horrible peaks and troughs. And I think that Mader is quite different. So what they do is they provide maintenance engineering for, it started off with all the big mobile equipment. So you think about a big Caterpillar dump truck or something similar out for the mine, started by a guy called Luke Mader, working out in the Pilbara as a diesel mechanic for one of these big original equipment manufacturers, think like Caterpillar. And then, you know, saw this a huge opportunity, which is basically that there was this gap in the market where the existing providers, so the guys that made the equipment, would then provide service on the equipment. But the service they provided to them was more like a cash cow. And it's often the way that if you look at, it's one of the things that's often attractive about a hardware business is that when they go to do the servicing, they make very big margins on it and the spare parts, because you're kind of locked in a little bit. But he kind of saw this opportunity for a lot of equipment, you know, outside of its initial warranty. They weren't doing a very good job, basically. They didn't pay their staff particularly well. They were underutilized, just kind of slow. It was just kind of like a classic incumbent thing. And on the other side, there wasn't really a lot of independent, mechanics that could do the work that were at scale. And that's kind of where Luke Mader stepped in and started just with some friends, in the Pilbara, and expanded from there to where today they have a bit over 2,500 staff members. They've expanded from Australia into the United States, and they have a rest of world and Canada and rest of world segment as well. And they've expanded into other related lines. So basically, they're kind of core thing that the business does is recruit, you know, ideally the most talented diesel mechanics and other mechanics, and then they put them to work for, you know, these huge mining companies servicing their equipment. And what's different about it versus traditional mining services is a lot of mining services is tied to the exploration phase. So that's like going out and drilling holes, or they're tied to the kind of expansion phase, which is building the big mine. And those are both very cyclical, because exploration is the most cyclical when, you know, gold or whatever, you know, iron ore price is high, everyone goes and does a lot of exploration. And then when the price falls, that completely stops, or almost completely stops. The construction phase is also cyclical, not quite as cyclical, but everyone goes and builds a big mine. Obviously, once you build it, you don't need to keep building it. But maintenance kind of keeps happening, particularly if you're with one of the low-cost producers, almost regardless of price. Like, there's kind of a base within any mining commodity where there's some producers who just keep producing. And if the price is high, they make a lot more money. And if the price is low, they don't make as much money, but they kind of tend to want to keep the volume up. You know, the price has to really fall for that to be hit. So the net result of all that is that I think MADE is quite different from a lot of what we compare mining services companies to, where there's a lot less cyclicality and the ability to expand. They're also very capital light, because they don't need to buy like a big drill rig or something. They just in Australia buy a truck and send them out.
Their equipment's more off the shelf equipment, not super boutique equipment.
Yeah, super. It's not off, and also just the ratio of equipment to staff is a lot lower on the, like, you need less equipment basically.
They do have the staffing expense. Do they have any of that dynamic like the IT companies we talked about recently, where you'd have a situation where if work dropped away, you still have a lot of staff on the books and then you get a problem there?
Great question. They do have it structured differently, which is partly the nature of the industry, where the people who work for MADE, the vast bulk of the workforce, are casual employees or casual contractors. And they prefer that because the guys that work in these are typically younger men, and particularly MADE's like demographic skews towards, you know, younger, mostly guys who want to make as much money as possible in the shortest time. And so they actually prefer to have that versus like a fixed income, because you get a higher like cash in hand, basically, if you're casual versus not. And so that does mean there is more flex with MADE. If there was a downturn or they need to redeploy, you know, they only deploy people when they've got work for them. Obviously, that's still something to manage. Like, you could, if you did have a really severe downturn, there's going to be some, you know, gaps or stoppages. But it does make it quite different from having everyone where the nature of the industry is fixed contractors or fixed employees, and then you've got to deploy them. So it does give them the breadth to kind of scale up and down if that happens.
Such an impressive history since listing, I got to say. I mean, the revenues have
grown. I can't live. I sat on my hands with this one painfully. I think the last time we talked about it, I didn't own shares. Now I did own shares. I didn't even get the full holding I wanted. Like, it's just been painful. I've watched this and been like, yeah. And then it's one of those ones where I spend the whole time being like, just want it 30 cents cheaper kind of thing.
It's executed really well, as you're kind of saying. So they've expanded from Australia. They've I guess what I think about, again, this is the bull case, so we'll present some other risks and stuff later, but the ability to replicate a similar type of model over and over again, I think, is really common in companies that go on to become, you know, successes. And MADE has kind of done that already in Australia, like expanding from iron ore to other commodities, expanding from the West Coast to the East, but also now expanding internationally. And that was kind of a big push for them, was to go into North America, into USA, and most recently Canada in the tar sands. Because I guess at the end of the day, there's just a lot of different areas that require maintenance. Like, it's kind of the whole side of the economy that we tend to forget about. But yeah, the net result, as you're saying, is there's just been this long tailwind of, well, a long history of growth, basically. They've compounded growth at something like 32% for 5 years. And in the most recent, you know, the most recent quarterly, that actually has accelerated, in large part because of the expansion in North America, but also in Australia, still growing very strongly as well. So in North America, they grew year over year 194%. In Australia, which is where the, you know, majority of their revenue comes from, they also grew 39% year over year. So again, it's two pretty strong results, which meant that their EBITDA grew about 50%. Yeah, so I think strong quarterly update. They don't have to do a 4C. They're choosing to do a quarterly operational update for this one, which I kind of like. And I guess one other note though is the cash. Although they're not capital intensive, the business does consume cash as it grows for two reasons. One, they do still need to buy those trucks, and in North America they have to buy slightly bigger equipment. They buy like a Ford F-150 and put a crane on it, which just costs more. Part of the reason why they have higher margins there, but anyway, but also working capital. They have to pay the workers, and then they get the terms from the miners. So they might, you know, have say 60-day payment terms. They have to float the cash in the meantime, which just means as you grow, you consume some of the cash. They have been very internally funded, so they don't have a history of going out and raising. But they do have some debt. And so that just means that from a free cash flow perspective, you have this dynamic where as they're growing, you don't see a heap of the free cash flow, but the moment they stop growing, it all kind of gets realized, if that makes sense. It is just something to keep in mind when you're watching this. You need to make sure that you're keeping track of, you know, how much debt and how are they growing, basically, because you want to make sure they don't get out in front of their skis.
Strikes me of the value of having a very frontline execution oriented manager founder is just so good. It reminds me a little bit of Daryl at Burson / Bapcor back in the day. Just that it's very easy to abstract away a lot of the detail, you know, in the corporate boardroom. But both of those. Anyway, I might not be making a fair comparison here, but it strikes me as that's sort of the secret sauce for what is otherwise pretty straightforward business, and you'd wonder where are the real significant lasting competitive advantages here? But that operational focus and excellence, like, it counts, right?
It does, yeah. And I should just clarify. So Luke Mader is still active in the company. He's on the board and is kind of head of their growth and strategic development. But they also recruited a CEO, which I think is very high quality CEO, Justin Newich, a couple of years ago. So, but Luke, the founder, still owns 56% of the company. Another director owns 19%. So insiders have about 75% share ownership. And they have what I really like is a really good incentive scheme tied to net profit results in FY24 and FY26, which is shared among a lot of their senior leaders. And I think it's just a very strong way to align people. The point about moats is really interesting with this one, because it's not like a software company, right, which has like this very clear IP moat. I think it's got small moats or small edges that kind of compound together, and it's partly why it's easy to overlook. And so I think that they've got basically culture, I think, is really important, and cultural moats can be, I think, really valuable, but they're kind of fluffy, right? Like it's hard to say it beforehand.
I agree with that. Sorry to interrupt, but one issue with the cultural moats can be it's very hard to spot when they go away. I think maybe like while they're there, it's hard to know how deep they are, in the sense that like perhaps you can know how wide they are if we use wide as a metaphor for how much of an advantage is that over the competition. But it's hard to know how deep they are, like how easily could get filled in. Like are we, you know, two bad hires of a toxic manager away from losing somebody who should have become the manager but got passed over, some toxic person got in there instead, then half the team quit and set up competitors. Like that could happen, right? So
No, I think it's a great point, Claude. I think it's the hardest thing to watch from the outside. And I just maybe a good time to jump into some of the risks, because I think cultural degradation over time would be the biggest risk. It's a hard one to monitor, as you say, because it's hard to get that read on what it is in the first place, aside from talking to former employees. We did talk to a few formers before. Actually, one of the things that I liked was talking to a former employee who left to start their own business, actually had a lot of really good things to say about Mader and kind of described them as being kind of the default in the business. And what was the word he said? They're in a league of their own, far above. They've got a huge reach. They're the go-to, basically. But yeah, I think that's a great point. Like that's one of the easily the biggest long-term risk, in my view. And maybe another one is just like a big slowdown in China. We've talked a lot about the risk of China before. Iron ore prices rebounded the last few months because China's reopening, but iron ore is about 40% of Meta's business still, although it's shrinking as they expand into other things internationally, etc. It's still a big chunk. And Australia's iron ore goes largely to China, which use it to make steel. Steel is used to make apartments and infrastructure. And those are kind of the two areas of China's growth that I think are most at risk. So, you know, the counter to that is maybe Meta's servicing customers like Rio and BHP that have very low costs. So it would be have to be a real big fall before they start feeling it. But
The economy of Australia is like reliant on like China continuing to build empty apartments.
Yeah, it's definitely
empty highways. Definitely,
it's not just
but also China's reliant on it as well, right? China needs to keep building them, but they've removed the one child policy. You know, they've like, oh my god, we've got so many apartments, guys.
Yeah, I mean, they're and failing as we talked about, right? Like they've removed the one child, and people don't really want two kids anymore because it's expensive, etc. So. Yeah, so I think that's
humanity is, you know, needs to question, you know, humanity has such a different dream of like where you want society to proceed to. You know, like the dream of some people is that they run an authoritarian state and everyone lives in little boxes in the sky. But you know, is that actually going to happen? Is the question. But surely, you know, if it keeps
my ideal.
No, but if it keeps them in power in China, surely they'll just keep on building or they start a war.
Probably a bigger topic, but I think there's a level where you, if you make enough bad investments, you just lose the ability to make any more investments, basically. Like there's a certain amount of unproductive investment where it just starts to destroy the whole economy. But I've been thinking that for several years in China, so I've been bearish on that. You know, that part of the economy in China for literally like 6 years now. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah.
It's gone on way longer than I thought it could have gone on. I guess we'll see whether it ultimately does end up collapsing or if they find some other way to pivot. But
feel free to bat this one away if you don't want to answer it. But it's a, you know, over the last couple of years, it's gone from $1 to $4.30. And, you know, I can imagine. I mean, Claude, you mentioned before, it was like, oh, you know, could have, would have, should have type thing. Just thumb sucking it here, it looks like a PE of about, it's always nice to talk about PEs as opposed to price to sales or price versus ACV or something, but seems about 22 on a forward basis or something. I'm just curious as to your thoughts on value. And
it's a great question because I was thinking about this and I thought, like, in some ways, I think this could be similar to Johns Lyng Group, which do repair for insurance companies. Like, it's got a large workforce. It's like, but that's become a darling, which is on, you know, over 30 times earnings. So it's tumbled a little bit recently because and people love that because it's stable, but then you've got this upside when there's disasters. So people just love that stock. Mm. But then on the flip side, if you look at if it's a mining services company, it's crazy expensive, right? Mm. So mining services companies trade for like 5 to 10 times. Mm. If it's a services compounder with like not a huge cyclicality like Johns Lyng, then maybe it's towards the cheaper side. I'd say like the valuation has increased. I'd say a lot of the price increase though is just how much the earnings have grown. Again, when you're growing, you know, 50% or 40 to 50% a year, that does cover quite a chunk of that. But at the same time, that there's no doubt it has re-rated. That's not how, obviously, I do DCF, et cetera. Sorry, Claude.
On that dichotomy you created, just wanted to explore that a little bit. Interesting idea there. One of the things we were talking about, the growth of, say, IT services companies, which, as we've discussed, not a perfect proxy for mining services, but one of the things we did discuss was probably better for the more organic growth stories. So, I mean, that would be... it's been just mostly organic growth for Matter, hasn't it?
100% organic, actually.
Yeah, that's what I
had looked at an acquisition.
I was trying to recall if there had been some acquisition pre-IPO, which I'd forgotten about.
I can't think of any. Yeah, I'd have to dig into the archives. I think it's been entirely organic.
That's
tiny little
favor.
Stuff. Like they'd bought like a workshop repair thing, but they actually later sold that one. So there might be something small, but otherwise it's all organic.
But either way, more to the organic side of things, which can be a good sign.
Yeah.
Yeah, so talking about the risks again for a moment, I just wanted to zoom in on the change in net debt that they disclosed. So at the full year, it was around $26 million debt. That's come up to about $50 million debt. So a bit of an increase again in debt implying in this quarter and also for the half year, I'd expect perhaps you know, negative cash flow, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or negative free cash flow. And so as a result of that, should we be worried? Is there going to be any kind of funding pinch?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I'd say it's something to keep monitoring. Again, as I was saying before with the, like, what PE should it be on? It's kind of like pricing versus value. You know, I value this on a discounted cash flow. So I'm forecasting out cash flows. And I do have negative free cash flow for this year. And I kind of would expect that in any year that has like a particularly big step up in growth, because they have to buy the trucks kind of, you know, partway through the year. So they don't get like the full year effect immediately, if that makes sense. And same with the working capital. You kind of like, if they did a big surge towards the end of the year, they have to do all that working capital immediately. And you kind of get a roll through in the following year of the benefit of that investment, if that makes sense. Like, it's a pretty short time, but it's still, when you're growing fast, that has that effect. So yeah, I guess the first thing is their overall debt level is still very low, like compared to other mining services companies relative to their size and ability to fund. You know, they're making very high EBITDA that can, I think, cover that, you know, relatively quickly. And they have traditionally had they've had like a conservative approach to debt, which I think relates to the fact that it was founder led and bootstrapped, where they tie their debt to their receivables. And I think the idea is, like, even in the worst case, they would have enough cash coming in from their receivables to pay off their debt. I think that's part of what's going, because normally companies don't think of it in that way. But I do think it's something to monitor, and it means that you do need to recognize that cash is going to, in any period of growth, you're not going to get the free cash flow, you know, or it will be hurting free cash flow because you need to invest for that. On the flip side, I kind of see it as a positive, because they started the year only planning to do, say, 30 million of CapEx. And I think they're probably going to do closer to, you know, 40 to 50 million, which reflects the fact that they're growing more than they had originally expected. And so I could see, like, it seems pretty likely, unless something goes wrong in the next 6 months, that there's another upgrade to guidance. They're already kind of run rating at, around or above guidance. So yeah, but I think it's a great one. It's a great question of the risks. If that got too big over time, then you have the slowdown risk becomes a lot greater. At the moment, I think the business can survive a slowdown and then go on to rebuild if we did have a big kind of mining slowdown. Maybe one other point positive is, we've talked a lot about like green mining before. I think that these guys have some, I'm bullish mining over the long term, although there can be hiccups with China. So I see some long-term tailwinds there. But yeah, in terms of risk, I do think it is probably one of the other big ones to watch. So thanks for calling it out, Claude.
Cool. All right. Shall we finish off on a couple bit more of quarterly news? This is, I guess, it's a busy period in small cap land. So I went to Twitter to see if any of our listeners had some suggestions, and I asked for the best quarterly reports. And one of my favorite things that put a smile on my face this morning is that at least half the respondents took that as best, as in the comedic sense, most amusing quarterly reports.
Yeah, so we definitely get a few of those. So maybe should we do some amusing ones?
Yeah. So, well, no, first of all, we'll start with, let's do one for Noddy, right? Because he gave us a serious answer of one that is an interesting little one, which I'm putting you guys on the spot here. It's an advanced braking technology. Now, this has come down, this has been in no man's land, but I just thought it was worth just shouting that out. That was an interesting one that did catch my eye as well, Noddy, because...
What was the ticker for that one, Claude?
ABV. I don't own it, and... Everybody just be totally aware, this is a tiny little microcap. I'm telling you this
about 15 million market cap.
yeah. I'm telling you this for interest sake, because, you know, that's what we study and that's what we're interested in. And that's the news. But the news was from these guys that they did a net profit after tax of $328,000. They have done year-to-date net profit after tax of $773,000. Both of these are, you know, big improvements for them. And on top of that, record sale, operating sales by quarter, as they call it. But yeah, so record there. So big up on the top level line. Also seeing that run through, operating cash flow, $560,000. Very little investing cash outflow. So call it $500,000 free cash flow for the quarter. Clearly on the numbers, as we said, an inflection point there. So you know, not.
Do you own this one, Claude? Sorry, did you say?
I do not own it. I don't have, you know, I haven't followed it closely, but part of the process of going through all these quarterlies, of course, is to say, oh, what are the ones that I haven't been following closely that are suddenly looking better? And we talked about, you know, Doug made it on or hadn't been on the list. Well, probably should have been on the list last December, but it wasn't. So better late than never. Let's get on the list. Write something about it on the articles for those that are interested. Doesn't necessarily mean I'll buy it, but, you know, this is a similar one that is going on the list now because it seems to have just changed its nature a little bit. And in investing, we're looking for those changes in the nature of the story and the finances. And sometimes we see the story and we can understand what's going to happen before we see the numbers. Sometimes we just see the numbers and that tells us the story is going on. And so that's the story there for ABV. Thanks for that suggestion, Noddy. Great fellow to follow if you're on Strawman as well. And now, of course, the other one, we have the best ones in a comedic sense. Our first level thinker suggested Dijkstra, as actually he said maybe that stopped getting any worse, but I feel like that's not funny for me. So we had the Pizza Shapes suggest Brainchip as an amusing one, and I, you know, scared to talk about that one, obviously, so skip that. So that leads us with Mindy's.
Because there's a lot of people who really like Brainchip who get very angry. If
I get regularly, like, tagged, like, by still, like, I hardly talk about it, and I still get, like, randos just, like, tagging me on social media being, like, trying to start some argument about Brainchip. I, like, literally don't think about them at all. Anyway, except to like want to avoid them. So, you know, okay, good for them, I guess. So the winner is DOU, Doe. Have you guys ever seen this? Has it got a 1.4 cents share price?
Mm-hmm. What's the market cap roughly, Claude? Do you know that one?
Gosh, I wouldn't. It was not one that I'd necessarily say for sure that the market cap that Commonwealth ComSec tells me 12.8 million.
Okay, ASX is 12.8. So
yeah, okay, so pretty good. Sometimes the ComSec one will be wrong if they have escrowed shares. Anyhow, so look, it's down there at 1.4 cents. I haven't seen many people tweeting about it recent, like obviously except Stock Swami, who's covered it on his Twitter page. Probably
down, what, 90%?
Yeah, so 95. I think he did a public service.
Mm-hmm.
There, because it's been a pretty disaster for anybody that I did get on board. Haven't followed the story close myself, but definitely agree. It is amusing I don't know how amusing it is.
When you don't own it.
We don't want to small, like, make our brains smaller with too much Schadenfreude, but you know, these guys were a bit of one that had a lot of buzzwords in it, so. Mm. They've soft launched the first phase of their app. It's got a consumer money app. It was forced to pivot its initial AU launch plan and re-architect its platform due to the closure of its BaaS provider, Vault Bank. So that's rough. And the actual numbers, $30,000 receipts from customers. So you can have a business that sells herbs on Instagram that probably makes more than that. Like, you know, chamomile tea and stuff. And
I thought you meant a different kind of herb for a second there.
I don't have Instagram, so I don't know what goes on there. Anyway, so Doe's pretty small receipts from customers there.
Which, I mean, we're fine to have, but it's more the burn in relation to it, right? So it's like 1.9 million of products burn on 30,000 receipts.
Yeah, so 2 million there and in the burn, and cash at the end of the equivalent's 3.3. So, yeah, look, you know, this is, I think this burst onto the market with some pretty interesting business plans a couple of years ago, which haven't really come to fruition.
Yeah, maybe. So, I mean, yeah, there's definitely stuff to that. I guess there'll be some people caught up in this that we feel for.
We don't want to laughing it too much, but yeah, I guess it is.
It's down 97% from its highs. I guess Claude's mentioned a rule that he follows before, which is you basically don't well, actually, maybe correct me if I'm wrong. I think you had a limit of like 5 million revenue before you take a company seriously.
Yeah, there's definitely $1 million plus revenue. Even for me to look at it, I probably want to see a minimum of $1 million a quarter.
I think for me, it's probably like 5 million a year at least, maybe even more, like 20 million.
But also, I think when I've written it, Matt, when I've written it as a bit of an article on trying to help people, I think I've gone higher than that, maybe even 10 million. I don't know. I guess the more experienced you are, the more you could go down. But I think a really great rule of thumb is, start with high revenue companies, and then if you want, you can go down. But honestly, if you limited yourself to stuff that makes $40 million a year, you'd still find tons of winners out there. So that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think there's we've talked about it before, but I just think it's a point worth emphasizing. The probability of losing all your money is a lot higher if you don't have any revenue, basically. Like if the company's not at that scale of, at least a few million of revenue, there's a lot of pre-revenue companies, which covers, if you think of the ASX as like roughly 2,000 companies, there's probably, I would say, 1,100 of those make less than 5 million of revenue a year. And a lot of those are going to be the disaster. I don't know what the disaster ratio is there, but you've got kind of all of speculative mining in there. You've got all the speculative biotech, and you've got a lot of other speculative other types of companies. And just the number that actually make it through, at least without huge dilution, is pretty low.
Yeah. Yeah. Business is hard. It's really hard.
That's why I
pay so much attention obviously it's one out of many things you look at, but even if it's pre-profit and pre-cash flow positivity, when you see really substantial, significant, sustained sales traction, I definitely start to get pretty interested around that point, especially if there's an inflection point to profitability in the not too distant future.
I still do think also anyway, though, is an interesting learning story for people. I would just go and look at what people have been saying about it. Even just go and read some of the old announcements, a few years ago with them. And it's good just to sometimes see what is the story, what is the kind of flashy story that didn't work out, essentially. And that can be useful as well. And obviously, we're telling you about one way to spot these potential risks is, the numbers aren't there, but then say the numbers aren't there and it's a very innovative, buzzwordy kind of situation, that can all be, there's a lot of, you can kind of start to get a feel for where there might be a bit too much excitement or hype in a stock and why, you can avoid that the next time.
Yeah, I think all of this is if it's priced in, right? The problem is not that you're buying a company with no revenue. It's that it's priced like it has a lot of revenue. Sorry.
Yes. Andrew. Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was going to say. So it's sort of like I just hear it all the time. Oh, I know, but they're going to do this. And it's like, yeah, okay, the price is expecting that. So they've got to do more than that. So anyway, it's the other thing I would emphasize too is that even – I think a lot of the time you can end up paying a higher share price, like to get a position, but be taking a trade that has a much, much better risk rewards ratio towards it. So, and either way, if half of the potential sort of comes through, you're still going to do exceptionally well. It's like you don't have to be in on the ground floor. But it sounds great, and obviously, if you're the first investor into Apple, well done you. But you can be the 1,000th investor and buy it, a price that's 20 times higher. And if the potential is still on track, you can still do extremely well out of that, but just have a much higher hit rate. So it's just worth emphasizing.
Yeah, maybe we should wrap it there, gents. We've got, I'm sure we'll have some more stuff coming up pretty soon with the rest of earnings season. But yeah, in the meantime, thanks for all that feedback on Claude's tweet. It's good to hear what people want us to chat about. You can always hit us up on Twitter at Baby Giants Pod. And if you're enjoying the pod, tell your friends. We do it for you guys. So we'd love to hear from a few more of you. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great day.